Sure. So my name is David Wagstaff. I work at the Department for Energy and Climate Change, where I'm responsible for heat policy. And I've been working in energy for quite a long time now, about 8 years altogether. I used to be in a department called the DTI, which doesn't exist anymore, but it's now the Business Department. And I was also in a department called the Office of Climate Change, which also doesn't exist anymore. So I was put into the Department of Energy and Climate Change right from day one when it was first founded. So I've been working on strategy and on heat things, really. So I've got the Department of Trade and Industry, but it used to be responsible for energy policy. There didn't used to be a department that was responsible just for energy and climate change. There used to be a department responsible for energy, which was the DTI, and then there was a department responsible for climate change, which was the Department for Environment, and then they basically stuck those two bits together and created this new department. So we're the newest department in government.
How did you come to be interested in working on energy?
By accident, really, because I've worked on lots of different things. In fact, I used to work on employment law and the minimum wage. That was the thing I was doing when I was at DTI. And then after I'd done that job, I was looking for a different job, and there just happened to be a vacancy in the energy group. And I've always been interested in environment and climate change, so when I went into the energy group, I kind of went into green energy. So when they set up an office for climate change, I was an obvious person to go over into that office because I understood about green energy. So it's been a really excellent path, but I haven't really planned it. It's just happened, which is quite, in my experience, quite often it's the best way is just to let things happen, because you never quite know what's going to come up next.
Back in the day, I'll just go straight to the question. Back in the day, people used to take energy for granted, but a lot of young people nowadays tend to. In your opinion, how could this be addressed?
Well, I guess one of the reasons people tend to take it for granted is because we haven't really had any problems with it. So there haven't been power cuts, there haven't been gas shortages. When I was younger, the coal miners were on strike all the time. We used to run out of power, we used to have candles. And I'm not that ancient. I'm talking about the 1970s and during the miners' strike. So basically since then, we've had a much more secure system. And I think what happens when something is secure and it works properly is people don't notice it. So I'm not saying, by the way, that we should make it insecure, because I don't want it all to start going wrong. But I think people only really notice things either when they can't get them or when they can't afford them. So I guess energy is an issue for people who are growing up in poverty, because it's really expensive. So, if you were talking to people in poverty, they would be thinking about energy a lot, but if you're talking to people who are kind of relatively comfortably off, they just pay their bills and they just use it. If they want to cook, they cook. If they want lights on, they put the lights on. If they want to turn the heating up, they turn the heating up, and they don't really think about the consequences.
What do you think? Do you think there's a lack of education in
Education? Yes, probably. I've got children at school, so I know that they do like environmental sciences, and I know that there's quite a lot about climate change and about kind of nuclear power and wind power and, weighing up all of the different impacts and everything. So I don't think it's completely ignored, but I think it tends to be about the kind of... it tends to be about the climate change side of things, and I'm not sure that there's really a basic understanding of how the energy system works. So where all the oil comes from and what we use it for, where all the gas comes from and what we use it for, where all the raw materials come from for nuclear power, how things work, basically. So I didn't know any of this stuff until I started doing this job, and I was in my 30s then. I didn't know any of it before then. It's a lot of it's about engineering as well. So I think probably part of my answer would be that there's probably not enough engineering being taught. You know, just how we make things. Because science is quite pure. You know, if you do chemistry, you're doing like molecules and elements and stuff. Whereas actually for energy, it's more engineering. It's like how you get things along pipes and, you know, how you generate stuff and how you distribute stuff. Well, it should do, because it does, like you say, it does affect everybody. I mean, every single street in the country has got some sort of electricity substation, you know, where there's like, you always get a sign saying danger of death and a little, but those electricity substations, they're what keeps the whole country going. But I very much doubt anyone really knows what's going on, you know, how it works. Yeah, I'm not suggesting we should all start poking around in them, but, you know, people don't really think about them, they just know that they're there.
Okay, so you spoke about how there's lack of education because we know it's but we don't actually understand the meaning behind what we're being told. How can we create more awareness about that, especially in communities?
Well, I mean, one thing which has worked quite well is where people get actively involved in making energy so that they're not just consumers. Because if you're just a consumer, it's like going into a shop and just buying anything you want. You don't really think about where it comes from or how it's made. But if you end up actually being a producer of energy, then obviously it gives you much more awareness of how much things, how difficult it is. And also just, so if for example, a school had solar panels on its roof, or if it started burning like biomass in the boiler instead of gas in the boiler, so you'd have to actually source your fuel. Schools could turn those into projects, because I kind of think it's a bit boring just looking at a gas meter and looking at an electricity meter. But if you're actually making it yourselves, then you could monitor, because obviously with solar panels, well, I say obviously, but, you know, if you think about it, with solar panels, they only work when the sun's shining. Same with wind turbines, they only work when the wind's blowing. So basically, it's a bit like those weather stations they used to have. You could actually do a correlation of, you know, how much difference does it make if it's a cloudy day? You know, how long does a day last, you know, in terms of actually generating electricity? Because
yeah.
Yeah, it's the same. It's the same with people who have wood burning stoves. I mean, obviously you can go and buy wood, but you know you can also. You have to be thinking: have I got enough wood there? You know, if you hear a weather forecast and it says it's going to be really snowy, then you have to make sure you've got a stock, because you don't want to run out during the snowy time, and you don't want to have to go out in really bad weather. But if you've just got gas coming through a pipe, you don't even think about it until the boiler breaks down, and then everyone panics. Yeah.
What was the question you asked in the lab?
Well, as I say, I'm responsible for heat policy. So I put on the cloud, why do we always seem to spend all our time worrying about how to make electricity? So, you know, I was talking about solar panels and about wind and about nuclear and all those sorts of things. But all of those are forms of making electricity. And obviously electricity is important. But if you look at how people, what energy people actually use, 80% of all the energy that we use is for transport and for heating. Right, so petrol for cars and gas for heating are the two most important things. And yet, if you have a debate, if you have a sort of a debate at school or a debate in the newspapers or even a debate on television with politicians, I guarantee that we're talking about nuclear power, that we're talking about wind power, that we're talking about coal-fired power or gas power. They'll be talking about power stations, right? But really, people should be talking about heating and they should be talking about transport. So that's what I wrote on my bubble. Yep. Well, fracking is just short for fracturing. So fracturing is where you go down into a certain type of geological rock formation and you put high-pressure water in it, which fractures it, and that will release, if you're in the right sort of rock, that will release some fossil fuel, gas primarily, or oil, I think. And obviously, we haven't needed to do that sort of extraction before, because up until now there's been plenty of oil wells and plenty of gas wells where you just sink a single vertical hole and extract it. But as we're running out of that sort of easy to access fossil fuel, people are increasingly, especially in America, using this fracturing technique. It's like I say about engineering, it's just another engineering technique really to get at the stuff that's under the ground. It's a way of accessing stuff that we couldn't previously get hold of.
Do you think it's possible to
this is where it gets really difficult for us in government, because we're trying to do two different things, two related things. One thing is to make sure we've got all the energy we need as an economy. So basically secure energy, make sure that the lights stay on, make sure that we're all as warm as we need to be, make sure that our transport system works. So we consume loads and loads of energy because we're obviously a well-developed, prosperous country. But at the same time, we've got to stop burning so much fossil fuel, because fossil fuel is causing climate change. So what we've got here is a new source of fossil fuel. So on the one hand, it's good news because it means there's more fuel to keep the country going. But on the other hand, it's bad news because it's fossil fuel and we don't really want fossil fuel. We really want low carbon fuel.
There's an interesting one attached to fossil fuels too.
What we can do is we can burn fossil fuel gas in a power station and we can capture the carbon. So it's called carbon capture and storage. So that's a technology which actually lets you burn fossil fuel without adding to climate change. The problem with that technology is it's very, very expensive. Yeah, so you end up saying, well, at least we've got supplies of energy and at least it's not causing climate change. But the bad news is it means people are going to have to pay more. So the bills will go up, and then, of course, people will say, well, it's not affordable anymore. And in a nutshell, that is the policy problem we have in our department. Secure, affordable, and sustainable energy. Yeah, well, I mean, that's how we've written our objectives, yeah. So you have to define what you're trying to get to. It doesn't mean that we're like there now, but if you define what your goal is, at least you can kind of, when something new like fracking comes along, you can kind of look at it and you can say, well, is that going to help us reach our goal? Well, I'm going to refer you back to my previous comment, because it's a solution for making electricity, but it's not going to provide transport or heat. So what I would say is you have to open out your understanding of the whole energy system. So wind power is really important as a renewable, low-carbon way of making electricity, but you're never going to have enough wind farms or, you know, wind turbines to provide all the electricity you need, even at the moment. And if you then start making more electric stuff, so lots more electrical products, but also you might have more electrical heating and you might have electric cars in the future, if you start making everything electrical, then you're going to need an awful lot of new generation of electricity. So you certainly want lots and lots of wind, but I'd say it's probably not going to be enough. So I'd say it's an important piece of the jigsaw, but it's only one piece.
I've been hearing a lot of different technologies coming out for transport, similar transport, and there's electric cars, but something we heard recently was a solar powered bus that I think they wanted to use a special paint.
Mm.
And then it's like the pigments in it, it's like solar panels, and it helps.
There's an aeroplane flying across the Pacific at the moment, a solar powered aeroplane. You've seen that on the news? Yeah, he's trying to fly around the world in a solar powered plane, and he had to stop in China because there was a storm or something, and he's just taken off again. And it's like, obviously it's really light with really big wingspan, and obviously you don't get any solar power during the night, and he flies non-stop for 5 days across the Pacific Ocean. So he's got little batteries. So it's probably the same basic principle as the bus. You take the sunshine when it's shining, you store it in little batteries, but they have to be really light, because it's actually quite difficult to store electricity, and if you have lots of weight, obviously it's not. So, I mean, it's a prototype. It's not, you know, you're not going to be flying in a solar-powered aeroplane anytime soon. But
is that the best technology, future technology you've heard so far?
There's quite a lot of exciting things being done. I think I mentioned batteries. I think probably the thing that would make the biggest difference to all of us would be if we find a more efficient way of storing energy, because even though we've got this really sophisticated national grid, and we've got, you know, we've got pylons and wires literally connecting the whole country with electricity, and we've also got a gas grid which connects about 80% of the country to gas, with pipes underground. You know, those two grids are there all the time, but you need to have the energy like the minute that people want it. There's no way of storing it, so the national grid has to be constantly balancing power stations with electricity, so when people boil kettles, it literally has a huge surge of electricity down all the wires. And similarly, when it's cold in winter and everyone turns their heating up, it literally just sucks all the gas through the pipes. So really what you want, and people are trying to develop these technologies, is really big, sophisticated types of batteries where you can store all the energy till you need it. Because that way, if you had a really nice sunny summer and a really windy autumn, right, you'd have all that wind power and all that solar power. But then when people want it all in the winter, you need to be able to store it all, because otherwise you kind of just have to use it when you've got it. So that's not an answer to... I don't know what the actual technology looks like, but I know that the people that we're trying to help with innovation and, you know, sort of research and development projects, a lot of it is to do with storing and batteries.
Because for me, I'm trying to understand, because I have research with energy, we've got, you know, our background in the group, and so I'm just trying to link my knowledge to my housing situation.
Yeah. Oh, don't worry, there are a few ways we can cope.
But the way we are going, you're right, we are consuming so much, and of course that will always be important for futures looking like. So I guess, could you explain, in terms of gas, electricity, heating, how this consumption actually happens?
So it's really interesting that you asked that, because with heating, our first question is always about the building. So with electricity, it doesn't really matter what you're using electricity for. So if you've got a great big power station over there, all the way up in, you know, Cumbria, there's a huge nuclear power station, you turn it all into electricity, it comes down the wires, and you can use that for anything. Just plug, you know, it goes into every house, right, through the national grid. So when you get your phone and you put it on charge and you plug your charger in the wall, it's taking electricity out of the national grid. But it doesn't really matter where that electricity's come from, because it's all just electricity. Once you've made the electricity, it goes down, you know, all the high voltage cables, and then it goes into the distribution network, and then you just plug into it and you literally just take a little bit of electricity out for you. But when it comes to heating, so in a sense, it doesn't really matter where you live or what you use your electricity for. You just know there's some electricity there. But when it comes to heating, the answer to your question depends completely on whether do you live in a flat, do you live in a house, you know, do you live in a big house in the country, do you live in a small house in the town, because it will make a difference to your heating system. Well, because if you're in a big block of flats, you probably haven't got a gas boiler, because blocks of flats tend not to have gas boilers in every flat, because it's not very safe. So what you've probably got in a block of flats is you've probably got a great big boiler in the basement, and maybe a kind of caretaker or person, a bit like with the school, who spends his time or her time looking after the heating system. And then, you know, you might have like electric fires or whatever in your own house. But if you're in like if you're in the suburbs and you live in like a detached house or a semi-detached house, most likely, I'm guessing you would have a gas boiler, and you've probably got a thermostat that controls central heating, and probably radiators in all your rooms, and maybe a hot water tank. So I mean, so it really depends. People live in very different. Some people have no central heating. They just have a fire, or they just have, some storage heaters. So the gas, if you've got a gas boiler, then a qualified gas engineer, you can never do this yourself, a qualified gas engineer would have put the boiler in right at the beginning when the house was first built, and it will last 10, 15 years, and then it will have to be replaced. No, the gas literally comes down the pipes. So your house, if you stripped all the earth away from your house, you would see a whole load of different pipes and cables. So you'd see the water cables coming in, you'd see the sewage cables going out. Sorry, cables is the wrong word, pipes. So water pipes come in, wastewater goes out, gas comes in, electricity comes in, telephone or cable, you know, telecoms. There's just loads of different cabling and stuff. It's basically called infrastructure. And the energy infrastructure is what makes this country work, but we don't think about it, really. You don't really see it or think about it very much. You notice it when it's... I mean, obviously, it depends if you're running your own house or if you're living in your parents' house, then they probably worry about it more than you do. But, you know, sometimes the gas does actually stop. So if the gas got cut off or if your boiler stopped working, you'd notice it straight away. And then you have to get someone out and they have to put it all back on again. And gas is quite dangerous, because if you've got a gas leak, you have to call someone straight away, because, you know, you do get explosions. And you also get carbon monoxide poisoning. So actually, gas is not the safest thing in the world. It's a bit like petrol. Petrol's not the safest thing in the world either. You're not meant to store lots of petrol in your house, because it can blow up. So energy's quite... in fact, electricity's pretty dangerous as well. I was talking about substations and, you know, danger of electric... So, you know, all this stuff, it's why we need experts to deal with it, because you can't just, you know, you can't just think, oh, I'll go and have a go at that myself. Yeah. Well, I mean, I suppose any commodity which is really valuable is going to cause inequality, because obviously the countries that have got oil get rich by selling it. So if you look at some of the countries in the Middle East, they don't really have... they're not very fertile, they don't really have natural resources like that, but because they've got oil underneath the country, they've become very, very, very wealthy. But I don't think that's necessarily only true of oil, because it could be gold, could be it could basically be... if something is scarce and valuable, then you're very lucky if you've got it, because it's going to make you rich. I think the great thing about renewable energy sources is that there's plenty of sunshine and wind power and wood. You know, the things that you can use for low carbon energy are actually more readily available for everybody. So you don't just have a few countries in the world sort of stockpiling all of your natural resources. You know, and it's a reason why countries are really keen on solar power and, well, solar power in particular, but also like growing your own energy crops. You can basically do that. You know, you don't have to be a wealthy country. So countries like in the Mediterranean, you know, Cyprus, North Africa, places like that, there's loads and loads of solar panels, almost every house. For their hot water, they won't bother with gas, because they'll just have solar. They'll have hot water tanks on the roof, and they'll just have solar.
Yeah, that makes sense as well.
But you can see it next time you will. If you ever go to any country which is hotter than this one, so like, which is most countries, yeah. But if you go to like Turkey or Greece or southern Spain or somewhere, just, you know, if you're just on holiday and you're just in a, if you look, you'll see that they've got big tanks up on their roofs, and that's literally just hot water. They just stick them up on the roof, and it's really simple technology. They're just big hot water tanks, basically. So it's a form of renewable energy, but it's like not a really complicated form of renewable energy. So anyone can do it. You just go, you know.
So the sun boils the water, and then you get electricity.
Well, no, they just use it for hot water.
Oh, okay.
So you can make electricity with it, but this is what I was saying about heating.
Yeah.
You don't actually need electricity for heating.
That makes so much sense.
You just need the heat. So if you can get the heat straight from the sun, you don't need to turn it into electricity. You take it down some wires and then plug something into it, because that's really complicated. It's much easier to just have a big tank full of hot water, heat it all up with the sun, and then you run the, basically have hot water pipes. Doesn't work so well in this country, though.
No.
Good. I'm going to say I'm an optimist, because although I can think of problems to everything that we're trying to do, I genuinely believe that we will wake up to the need. I think it's happening all the time. Because I've been doing this for quite a long time. And, you know, people are getting more and more convinced of the need to do something about it. And, you know, you can take positives out of anything. So, you know, if we have some sort of shortage of energy, or if we have some sort of, you know, strange weather systems happening because of climate change, that will just raise people's awarenesses even more. So, you know, if we have... I'm not saying I want this to happen, by the way, but if there were like crop failures because of really hot, really dry, hot summers, not in this country, but in other parts of the world where they're much more reliant on the rainy season, if there's not a rainy season, and if they put that down to climate change, which is highly likely, then that means those countries are going to take it much more seriously. And this is a global problem. So what you need for a global problem is a global solution. And one of the problems we've got at the moment is that a lot of countries in the world are not really taking climate change seriously. But I think they will be forced to take climate change seriously when things start happening. So, you know, there are countries like Australia that don't really worry about it very much at the moment. But I think they will, because I think their farmers will start worrying that it's not raining enough. And I think that a lot of the islands nearby, people will start fleeing from like flooding and stuff. So, you know, you'll get a lot of movement of people, refugees. And as soon as you start getting climate change refugees, and as soon as you start getting shortage of water, shortage of crops, and as soon as the scientists say, well, we knew about this. You know, it's like your question about when you look back in the past. In 30 years' time, when they say, you know, why is everyone from, you know, from North Africa leaving because there's no rainfall, then the answer is, well, we knew this was going to happen. We know this is, you know, we already know about it now. So that doesn't sound very optimistic, maybe.
No.
But I genuinely think that people will not just be able to sit there and ignore it. I think they'll have to do stuff about it.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.